This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Send them all to jail. Expel the kids.
Cancel the science. Send home those negative naysayers frightening our kids. That is Washington's solution for climate change. California's climate scientist and WeatherWest blogger Daniel Swain covers the latest U.S. purge of weather and climate science. But first, a new public health study about your body. How much heat before lasting damage kicks in? From the T.H. Chan School of Public Health at Harvard, Dr. Robert Mead on how heat kills. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm your guide, Alex Smith. In these days, disruption of human affairs competes with disruption of nature. Who can pay attention to it all? Superheat is here, but it is not evenly distributed. In mid-April, summer arrived in eastern Europe, while Spain was kind of chilly. The U.S. Southwest baked in 100-plus degrees temperatures, 38°C, while snow fell in Ontario, Canada, to Albany, New York, and Maine.
Australia has experienced its hottest 12-month period on record, ending with its hottest March on record. With last month seeing temperatures 2.41 C above average, the Bureau of Meteorology has confirmed.
41 degrees C, about 106 Fahrenheit in the shade on the southern coast of Australia, April 13th. That is a summer heat wave in the fall in Australia. All the Pacific islands of Oceania are suffering through heat, and it doesn't cool down enough at night. South China is way too hot. Northern India is roasting. We will hear more about that soon with Robert Mead, who was just there. And so what we see across multiple continents, not a consistent warming of the world, but strange alternating waves of extreme unseasonal heat in one place and colder than usual in another. The total is still warmer than ever, of course, but it is not evenly distributed. This confuses us humans.
Welcome to the new world. Hot new world.
Hurricanes and wildfires get the headlines, but the real killer of climate change is barely reported. Extreme heat is killing millions of people around the world. Over 50,000 dead in one European heat wave, and thousands even in northern countries like Russia and Canada. In the tropics, where it's worst, we do not have accurate figures. So it is shocking to find out we are not even sure what the safe levels of heat and humidity are. Do you know your limit? Dr. Robert Mead leads a team of scientists trying to find out. Mead is a postdoctoral research fellow in epidemiology at Harvard's well-known T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He is lead author of the March 31st paper in PNAS titled Validating New Limits for Human Thermoregulation. From Massachusetts, Robert Mead, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Alex, thanks for having me on.
As we speak in the middle of April, in northern India and Pakistan, temperatures are soaring up to 49 degrees Celsius, 120 Fahrenheit, and that's 8 degrees above normal. In the northwestern Indian city of Ahmedabad, with 7.5 million people at least, the temperature is already well over 100 degrees Fahrenheit daily, and forecast to break 40 degrees C soon, weeks ahead of normal for this time of year. Robert, you recently returned from Ahmedabad. What were you doing there?
Yeah, so our team here at Harvard at the Salada Institute for Climate and Sustainability South Asia Cluster, we're running a kind of first-of-its-kind long-term study evaluating not just how people experience heat kind of at the workplace or during kind of peak heat wave conditions, but throughout the course of an entire year. So we're working with the Self-Employed Women's Association, which is a central trade union in India representing more than 3 million women working in the informal sector in India. Now, this came as a surprise to me when I started the study, but over 90% of India's workforce is informal, so they fall outside the kind of normal workplace regulations. And we're instrumenting their homes and workplaces with temperature sensors. We're providing them with wearable monitors, taking regular measurements of things like kidney function to really ascertain, you know, how is it that these women are exposed to heat throughout the course of an entire year, and then how does that affect their health, their well-being, their earnings, etc.
Okay, so to get to the basics, to gauge heat danger, experts use a measurement that combines both heat and humidity. It is called the wet bulb temperature, which mystifies most of us. Why do we need to know both heat and humidity?
Yeah, so the key reason behind needing to also understand the humidity someone is exposed to is because the primary autonomic or physiological way that humans dissipate heat to maintain core temperature within safe limits is through sweating. Now, it's actually the evaporation of that sweat that does the cooling. So if we can't evaporate sweat, it just drips off our body and it doesn't provide any sort of cooling benefit, any heat dissipation from the body. So when there's a lot of moisture in the air, which is registered as a high humidity or a high wet bulb temperature, it basically tells us that our drive for sweat evaporation from the skin is reduced, and therefore the level of heat stress actually experienced by the body is going to increase, even if air temperatures are relatively low.
Well, everybody needs to understand our body is not a quick heat mirror, and I learned that mainly from your paper. The essential core temperature around key organs takes hours to lose control and break down, so it isn't the quick dash to the local store that kills us. Robert, tell us about heat, humidity, and how long we can tolerate exposure.
Yeah, so this is kind of a multifaceted question, and I think we're going to get into this in a little bit, but we can think of heat stress in kind of two ways, and thermal physiologists like myself often kind of categorize heat stress into what we would call compensable and uncompensable heat stress. Now, this is exactly what it sounds like is the body able to compensate for the level of heat it is experiencing? So in a compensable heat stress, and we think of this in terms of wet bulb limits, these are basically scenarios in which the body is gaining so much heat, whether it be through metabolism or a hot environment, or just that we can't dissipate enough heat. So we're gaining so much heat that we can't offset this with heat loss, that our core temperature is just going to stream up and up and up. And in these environments, heat stroke can be reached relatively rapidly, you know, even within 3 to 6 hours, depending on the level of heat stress we're experiencing. Now, by contrast, even when we're in conditions where our body temperature can work as expected, so we would call this compensable heat stress, the body can compensate for the level of heat stress, maintaining a stable internal temperature, even if conditions are, you know, moderate to hot, requires that our body actually sustain some level of strain. So our core temperature needs to be elevated to activate sweating. Our heart has to beat harder to help facilitate blood distribution to the skin. And we're also losing fluid, becoming dehydrated. Now, in these environments, we're more and more convinced that it's not necessarily the acute level of heat stress that can cause injury or death. It's potentially the prolonged heat stress over multiple days. If you think of a heat wave lasting, you know, as many as 3 to 6 to a week to even months, as we've seen in Phoenix last year. But this kind of consistent strain on the physiological systems can set us up for failure, particularly in individuals who are already vulnerable. So for, you can think of people with clinical conditions like heart disease, diabetes, whose maybe internal systems just can't shoulder that level of heat for extended periods.
And also interesting in your study, our bodies manage to cope with heat for a while, and then rather suddenly the core temperature goes up. It's almost like there's a tipping point inside us. What does that tell us?
So this is what we think of, this kind of tipping point in the study. In the context of this was we're exposing the participants to a given level of air temperature, and then we're slowly ramping up humidity. And what we see is that core temperature is stable for some period, and then it inflects and starts to increase rather rapidly. And this is what we take as the border between those conditions I was mentioning, compensable versus uncompensable heat stress, the border of conditions where the body is able to maintain core temperature, and then the conditions in which the uncompensable heat stress, which it just can't, and core temperature starts to increase rapidly.
In a way, I think of heat danger a little bit like fire risk. When it's really hot, fire risk increases, but it takes ignition to become a fire, like, you know, lightning or arson or something. And it can be very hot with high conditions, and yet it's not too bad if the humidity isn't too high. So we have heat waves and we have humidity waves like atmospheric rivers, but maybe the two collide and combine and we have killer heat humidity waves. Is that possible? And what would we call that?
So I think this is the idea behind the concern about extremely elevated wet bulb temperatures into the future. So we know some areas of the planet are, I mean, most of the planet is increasing in temperature, and humidity is actually increasing a little bit quicker than temperature in some areas. And in certain regions, particularly in, you know, North Africa and South Asia, including India, we are seeing these wet bulb temperatures, these combinations of air temperature and humidity approaching what we might consider limits for human thermoregulation. So this is, of course, if this is in fact occurring, very concerning for health and safety in these areas.
Yeah, even parts of the Middle East right along the Red Sea there have higher humidity than you would expect for a desert, and they're in danger of going beyond survivability if you don't have air conditioning. So we spoke about extreme heat with Greek scholar Dr. Matt Santamouris. He told us heat tolerance also depends on prior experience. For example, when it's 96 degrees in Athens, Fahrenheit, or 35 C, there's no increase in visits to the emergency department. People kind of expect that, but even 32 degrees C or lower, 90 degrees in the United Kingdom, more people go to the emergency ward due to heat-related problems. What do you think about cultural adaptation and heat safety?
Yeah, so this is actually a really important question and something that we need to explore more and more. As you mentioned, we know that in areas that are generally hotter, the thresholds for when we start to see hospitalizations, when we start to see heat-related deaths, are typically at higher temperatures. Now, this could be due to a whole host of different factors. We know that a body exposed to heat for even just a couple weeks will start to sweat earlier, kind of regulate core temperature at a lower value, even at rest. And these are kind of the hallmark signs of acclimatization. A big part of our response to heat is behavior. So people in hot regions, rather, when it becomes hot, they already have some idea of, you know, what to do to stay cool. And then also the way we design cities. So, you know, I'm Canadian, and thing with heat in Canada is it doesn't get quite so hot, but because of the way homes are designed, is once the heat gets indoors, it stays trapped indoors. You know, we're used to dealing with cold temperatures, so this means designing our houses in such a way that kind of lock heat inside. Now, where this becomes really important in the context of this discussion around wet bulb temperature limits is that most of our understanding of critical limits for thermoregulation, or when conditions become too hot to regulate body temperature, has come out of laboratory studies in areas that are not those facing the most severe increases in wet bulb temperature. So we have our study, which was performed in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, the Veselio study, which gets quoted quite a bit, and we based our study off of, which was in Pennsylvania. And even the models that we now have emerging that are used to estimate limits without having to expose people to these hot laboratory conditions were developed with inputs from more temperate climates, North America, Europe, places like this. So I think there's still a bit of an open question on, even when we just think about the physiological limits for heat exposure, you know, are these reflective, are our current estimates reflective of individuals in the places that we see these really high wet bulb temperatures starting to emerge?
So is increased violence and suicides during heat waves a myth or not?
As far as my understanding of the epidemiological literature, you do see for every increase in mean daily temperature, mean max or daily max temperature, an increase in reports of violence, completed suicides, etc. So I don't think this is a myth. I think this is occurring, yes.
Well, I ask that question because the media will focus on heat deaths, but damages from prolonged heat could extend much further. In 2017, Dr. Camila Mora from the University of Hawaii talked to us about his paper, 27 Ways a Heat Wave Can Kill You. Yeah. Among many studies, he found extreme heat wave can damage major organs, and that might not kill us right away, but it could shorten our life later. What are your thoughts on this sort of extended life of heat waves?
Yeah, so this is actually a big goal of our group here at the Salata Institute. Including in this study in Ahmedabad mentioned up top, is really thinking about not just heat-related deaths, but also all the cascading ways that heat can influence lives and livelihoods. So just kind of going top to bottom, I mean, when we think about these wet bulb temperature limits, again, it's a really, you know, clear line in the sand. The conditions above which heat stroke develops rapidly and below which body temperature regulation can occur as planned. But even below these critical limits, you know, we still see cardiovascular strain, we still see strain on the kidneys, and this probably explains why heat waves kill more people through cardiovascular events than heat stroke. And for workers, thinking particularly of sugarcane workers, Mesoamerica, you do see increasing reports of chronic kidney disease that is most likely caused by prolonged exposure. And then even moving out from there, all these kind of downstream and secondary effects, increases in interpersonal violence, declines in mental health. And these can occur through a whole host of mechanisms we don't really understand currently. So in terms of the study we're doing in Ahmedabad, you know, if you're making a daily wage based on how much you can produce in a day and you're not able to work because it's hot, this decrease in earnings can have, you know, very cascading effects on food security, on ability to afford medication, on anxiety. So we're just now beginning to think about and really study how heat affects people, not just peak days during a heat wave, but when it's sustained over multiple days, multiple weeks, and through all these kind of secondary and insidious pathways.
Yeah, we're learning about long COVID, but I don't think most doctors or public health planners or any of us are aware of long heat. Why not?
I think historically, heat waves have been very hard to study for a couple of reasons, particularly the health effects of heat waves. For the longest time, it was relatively rare to have a heat wave in any particular place. So you're kind of studies on heat waves were a little bit opportunistic in the sense that, you know, you had to have data collection system, whether it be through medical records or even physiological studies, in place the time a heat wave hit. We didn't have the situation like we have now where we can, you know, bet pretty well that a heat wave is going to occur in, you know, most places around the planet in any given summer. The other side of the equation is that the attributing health impacts to heat waves is very difficult. And even things like heat-related deaths often kind of get missed in medical record. And this is because, as we've kind of been discussing, it's not just that you necessarily die from heat stroke. It's some cardiovascular event, maybe a kidney injury that is brought on by heat. But you show up to the emergency room or, you know, maybe the coroner, and there's no clear sign that this was, you know, triggered directly by the heat wave. So often, you know, on death certificates, you just get records like cardiovascular event, cardiopulmonary event, and then the fact that this was caused or at least triggered by heat gets lost.
This is Radio EcoShock. You're listening to Dr. Robert Mead from the Harvard Chan Center. We're talking about underestimated health risk during high heat and humidity, especially in a warming world. Your study found slow changes in body core temperature also mean it can take hours to cool down after exposure to hot, muggy weather. We pay attention to daytime highs, but tend to discount hotter nights. At least one expert suggested night conditions are key to letting the body cool down during a heat wave. Talk about night heat and humidity.
Yes. So more and more we're starting to understand the importance of not just the, like you said, peak daytime temperatures, but also high nighttime temperatures. We know that nighttime temperatures, even independent of daytime temperatures, are associated with increased health impacts of heat in the epidemiological literature. There's a lot of studies being done currently to assess this. But I think the key theory here is that, you know, if we're exposed to heat in the day, whether, you know, we're working outside or we're exposed to an overheated home, the night is where we're supposed to be able to cool down so we can, you know, open our windows, let the cold air in and get some reprieve, let our physiological system, let our bodies recover for that next day of exposure. Now, if nighttime conditions remain high, and we certainly see in India that home temperatures, because of the way they're designed, you know, you have poorly insulated and ill-ventilated homes that just trap heat inside. They stay very warm overnight. So if you're, you know, trying to recover in conditions that remain hot, you're basically setting yourself up for disaster the next day because you're exposed to that same heat wave, but you're starting from a kind of an already strained position.
Robert Mead, you also studied heat wave risks for older people. Talk to us about the challenges for seniors and their lower wet bulb heat tolerance.
Yeah, so a lot of my work at the University of Ottawa was done evaluating how older adults are impacted by heat. We did some of the first day-long heat exposure trials, so 9 hours of exposure to conditions similar to those experienced during heat waves in Canada. And there's a couple changes physiologically that occur as we age that increase our susceptibility to high temperatures. So on one side of the coin, our thermoregulation, our thermoregulatory function actually changes. So what we see in older adults is they have lower maximum sweat rates. So they're less able to increase evaporative heat loss. But the thermoregulatory system also shifts to higher temperatures. It takes a little bit longer for it to be activated when we're exposed to heat. So even when we can sweat enough to dissipate enough heat to maintain kind of a thermal balance or stable core temperatures, as we get older, that balance point occurs at higher and higher temperatures. So you can think of it if we're exposed to, you know, 5 days of the heat wave, each day we're experiencing higher and higher temperatures in our body as we get older. Now, on the other side of the coin, we also see that as we age, you know, our cardiovascular function decreases, our kidney function decreases. So not only is it that older adults are kind of experiencing more heat strain, they're also potentially have, you know, physiological changes that reduce their resilience to that strain. And this is likely why we see increases in cardiovascular events, kidney injuries, et cetera, in older adults during heat waves.
In 2023, we spoke with University of Sydney Professor Adrian Gordon. She specializes in heat safety for pregnant women. She found for each 1 degree C increase of heat brought a 5% increase in the risk of premature births in hot places and a 16% increase during heat waves. Who are the populations that need far more study before we can set true safety limits?
Yeah, so there are certainly a whole host of groups that we believe are at a higher risk of heat-related health events, as you mentioned, older adults as well as pregnant individuals. And vulnerability to heat kind of comes in two forms when we think about setting safety limits. So we have groups that are regularly exposed. So we think, for example, about outdoor workers or even indoor workers in hot, overheated factories, as well as individuals experiencing homelessness who, you know, can't often locate cool environments to cool off during heat waves. And then we have groups like older adults, like pregnant individuals, who, when they're exposed to heat, their physiology is perhaps not at a as good of a place at dealing with that heat, whether it be due to declines in thermoregulatory function or the fact that they also have a, we'll say, a whole other host of physiological responsibilities. So we can think of pregnant individuals as, you know, their body is also having to deal with the pregnancy. So the heat is just an added stress on top of that. Now, we're starting to understand how heat impacts these groups. But I think where the need for new research is to really evaluating these effects kind of across the globe. A lot of our estimates, again, come from you know, cooler environments, North America, for example, where some of the most exposed and most vulnerable individuals are living in the global south, and we're not really sure how best to evaluate and protect individuals in these areas.
Yeah, part of the problem is we don't have that one-size-fits-all hard limit. What are public health experts doing? Can we create an easy chart where people can check to see if it's safe to go out and for how long, or do we need an app for that?
Yeah, this is, I think, the million-dollar question. I know there are some apps being developed just looking at, you know, if you're going to go out and do certain physical activity or you're going to work, you know, these are the conditions or these are the temperatures it's safe to do so in. And certainly there are similar kind of lookup tables that are being used in occupational heat health guidance. I personally wonder whether there's ever going to be a universal kind of rule, particularly given the, you know, wide variation in conditions experienced across heat waves, the cascading and different ways that heat impacts the body, and just, you know, individual variation. We know that even if you look on paper, two individuals are the same stat, so to speak, they're the same age, same sex, on the same medication. You can bring them into a laboratory environment, put them in a climate chamber, and they might respond completely differently to the heat. So my feeling is we're never going to be able to just plug someone's information into an app and then really get a sense of the true heat risk.
Well, as the planet heats up faster than expected with no barriers in sight, I'm stunned we're still playing catch-up with basic health knowledge that we all need. Let's wrap up with two things. What are you working on now, and what are the priorities for public health research in a warming world?
Yeah, so the main goal of the current work is, again, to kind of bring the studies you would typically do in a laboratory environment into the field. So speaking about this work in India, where we're measuring temperatures, humidities, physiological responses in workers over the course of an entire year. Most of the work we've done in thermal physiology to date has been conducted in a laboratory environment, which of course allows us a nice controlled location to kind of make these measurements, but really doesn't get at the nuances of everyday life. And I think similar studies, whether it be on pregnant individuals, outdoor workers, children, are needed to really evaluate how heat impacts people in the real world. And then from these, what the kind of, I think, main goal of most of this work should be is to then see how we can leverage this information and leverage these very unique data capture systems to then actually make assessments of the efficacy or effectiveness of different proposed strategies in the real world, in the individuals who are being exposed to heat. So for an example, you often hear about cool roofs. So painting the roof of houses white to reflect incoming solar radiation to cool down the indoor environment. Now, there have been some assessments of indoor temperature changes with cool roofs, but really not that much currently that is looked at, well, how do these actual reductions in temperature, be it, you know, 1 degree, 2 degrees, 5 degrees, how do these impact the health of the exposed individuals? So kind of moving towards a way we can make these measurements and do these assessments in situ and in real life scenarios, I think is a very important goal for the future. I think certainly important to know, you know, when conditions become so hot for survival, but between, you know, normal, comfortable temperatures and those upper limits, there's this, we've been loosely referring to it as the zone of misery. So even if we're not at, you know, risk of health impacts or, you know, at high risk of health impacts, we still have to live our lives in these temperatures and, you know, how it impacts quality of life. This is, I think, a very important question and one that should receive a lot more focus than it currently does.
It may be something that doctors and other public health experts can use on a regular basis to save lives in a warming world. We can hope for that. From Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, we've been speaking with Dr. Robert Mead. He led the new paper, Validating New Limits for Human Thermoregulation. Find links to that and a number of excellent articles on heat in India in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Robert, thank you for sharing your expertise with our listeners.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Dismantling of NOAA, NASA, and climate research accelerates. That was a live stream science update from climatologist Daniel Swain on April 14, 2025. I bring you 27 minutes of key selections from the two-hour live stream. Search for the title on YouTube for the whole presentation or grab the link from my show blog, Dismantling of NOAA, NASA, and Climate Research Accelerates. Daniel Swain is a California-based communicator, often covering big storms, fires, and weather in the West. I was glued to his live stream reporting as wildfires burned into Los Angeles earlier this year. While mainstream media was fuzzy and hours late, Daniel swiveled through local cam shots of the fires, reports from the volunteer-sourced wildfire tracking app, Watch Duty. Then he tossed in official wind maps and weather forecasts. It was amazing, real-time coverage, and more amazing because Daniel was a bit sick at the time. He's just a fantastic mind operating with a wide range of sources. Swain is still cool but disturbed in his live stream last week as he chronicles the dismantling of his world.
What I want to do is just summarize where we are now. And for those of you who have been following, the last time I had this conversation about on the policy side of what's going on, been talking about how there were large-scale cuts to, for example, the National Weather Service component of the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, so National Weather Service within NOAA, and how this was already affecting our preparedness for extreme weather events, our extreme weather response, disaster response. And that the fact that the impacts were not more apparent already to most people is not because the impact of these cuts is small, but because of the valiant efforts of the people who remain in these now critically understaffed roles in field offices to maintain as much of a semblance of normalcy and efficacy as they possibly can. But the cracks are really now starting to show. At the National Weather Service, there are now a number of places that are critically understaffed, and I've been speaking with a lot of journalists in recent days. What they're finding is it has become exceptionally difficult to get people to go on the record who are currently still employed by the federal government, including some people who've been let go for all of the tumultuous reasons that we've been talking about, but especially people who are still employed by the Weather Service or NOAA or other agencies, because there has been cultivated an extreme culture of fear for understandable reasons, given the threatening and demeaning communications that are coming from the federal government, the Office of Personnel Management, and agency heads almost every day via email and internal communications, many of which have been leaked. I'm not speculating. The language of these is publicly available. But it's become really difficult for journalists to get direct access to what's going on. But what I've heard, I've pieced together some anecdotes from the Weather Service, some of which are close to home, some of which are a little bit farther from home. The most recent one is the National Weather Service in Sacramento publicly noted that they're no longer going to be offering social media updates under most circumstances. This has come to be a pretty important function of some of the local field offices with the Weather Service. Their updates on Twitter or X or Facebook or other entities, including during extreme weather events and disasters, because that's, you know, it's meeting people where they are. Essentially, it is communicating to people using the means and the mechanisms that they're using to interact with the world, which is a very important part of science and disaster and public communication. In any number of contexts, that's why we're having this conversation, for example, on YouTube. But the other piece here is that behind the scenes, what's going on is that the Weather Service in Sacramento is now critically understaffed. And it turns out that the primary reason why they're not offering this is not because they've necessarily been instructed to stand down, for example, but the real reason is arguably worse. They do not have the person power anymore to do their critical forecasting duties and offer those updates to the public using all of these media. That's concerning because this was a pretty important function, and they managed to find a way to do it in the past, even under significant time and personnel pressure. So the fact that this is just a bridge too far now is a real indication of person-hour triage, of critical understaffing. And we've, of course, heard that in other circles. We know that the Weather Service office for the San Francisco Bay Area, based out of Monterey these days, has lost people, that has greatly increased the workload for other people. We've heard this for other offices, either within or serving California. But there's other stories emerging from other regions. This is going to degrade weather forecasts to some extent, and the effects may not be obvious until there is a major tornado outbreak or a hurricane landfall downwind that doesn't go so well. I don't think this is probably all that unrepresentative of what's going on elsewhere. It's just that it's very difficult to get people to speak because, quite frankly, everybody is fearful for their jobs, and there's every reason to believe that there are people being singled out who are speaking with the media, people who are singled out for leaking information about what's really going on. I'm hearing this all the time. Okay, so that's catching us up to a couple of weeks ago. Now I'm going to bring up some more recent information. By the way, there are other federal labs that are having to shut down operations. Scientists have already taken up things like janitorial services. They're cleaning their own bathrooms when they're still working. They're taking out the garbage. That in itself is a frustrating use of time. Not that those activities are not critically important, but of course we had fired all the people whose job it was to do that professionally, the janitors, the maintenance workers from these facilities. But more importantly, in certain labs and even in certain operational settings, there are a certain number of hazardous materials that are contained on premise in these labs that are used day by day. And there are specialized teams of people with specific qualifications, as you might expect, who are expected to handle that hazardous waste resulting from science and operations. And up to a certain point, it can be stored on site and accumulate, but it's getting to the point where some labs are now having to shut down their operations because we fired everybody with the legal authorization to handle hazardous materials. And so we're left at the point where you're either going to force people who have no training in handling hazardous materials to somehow dispose of them, which would likely be, by the way, a federal crime for people without that legal qualification to handle those hazardous materials or dispose of them. And so in most cases, they're not being disposed of. They're accumulating up to the maximum allowable level, and these facilities are just having to shut down these labs because there's nobody to take the hazardous materials away. Anybody can empty the waste bin into the dumpster, right? But not everybody has the ability to take those chemicals out from under the fume hood and properly dispose of them in a safe and environmentally acceptable way. There are some people, by the way, who I've heard from who were fired now three different times since February, and of course the net effect is that nobody feels particularly secure, even if they remain in their jobs. And that is not surprising because down the pike, there is now, again, credibly rumored. And by the way, I use the term credibly rumored because it's impossible to get official communications right now. But everything else that's been credibly rumored in the space so far this year has already come to pass that I've talked about previously. So I don't necessarily have any qualms about referring to it this way. There are credibly rumored to be another massive set of layoffs coming to NOAA and other agencies, but specifically to NOAA, I can talk about on the order of 20 to 25% additional. So what we've seen so far is about a 15% attenuation of the workforce at NOAA overall, including people at the National Weather Service and the research labs. What is expected to come next is an additional 20%+ reduction. Again, so this would be an even larger increment than the previous one, resulting in net 40%+ attenuation of the total workforce. And that is before what I'm about to talk about, in addition to that, might go into effect. So that's where we are now. We don't know what's going to happen with what's known as a reduction in force or an RIF, but it's essentially extending now well beyond the probationary employees potentially who were fired originally in February, then again in March, and then in some cases a third time this week. Last week, a couple of additional developments. I believe it was Tuesday that the U.S. Global Change Research Program, the entity that is responsible for compiling the National Climate Assessment, which is a congressionally mandated report on the observed and expected impacts of climate change in the United States. The executive branch has terminated the contract with the company that administered that. That involved about 20 people who were actually administering the program. By the way, nearly all of the work on the science and writing side, so on the non-administrative support side, was essentially volunteer work by scientists around the country, including many of my colleagues. The most of the federal government expenditure on behalf of them over the years was generally things like a $1,000 travel reimbursement when people had to fly to D.C. for a couple of days for a meeting. That's pretty much the extent of it. People did not draw a salary. They were not paid stipends generally. It was essentially a volunteer work on their part. But the problem is, because of that, you did need professionals to actually physically put the report together and administer all the coordination that was required into producing a congressionally mandated report, which then becomes a formal government document. Well, it now appears that report likely will not move forward, even though it is still congressionally mandated, because there's no one left to administer it. And it really can't be done fully on a volunteer basis, because everybody who is volunteering has full-time jobs doing other things as scientists and professors all around the country. So it is quite plausible at this point that there will not be a congressionally mandated, there will not be an update to the National Climate Assessment when it was required to be released, either in 2027 or 2028 as a result of this. That's an active thing that's still sort of unfolding, but right now, unfortunately, it appears that's likely to be the case. Well, there'll be an independently released alternative to the federal report that's a possibility, but it's going to be difficult to stand that up, I think. And it certainly won't have the influence that a formal, again, congressionally mandated document would have. Also, last week, the Department of Commerce, specifically NOAA, ended a long-standing cooperative agreement with Princeton University and the what's known as the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory, or GFDL, which is a cooperative agreement between the federal government and Princeton to operate a weather and climate modeling research lab that has that is famous the world over. And it has been essentially the test bed for most weather prediction models and in many cases, some of the latest climate predictive models that are out there. Some of the most significant advances in weather and climate prediction in recent years have come out of this space, and the cooperative agreement between the federal government and Princeton University that made it possible has been, to my understanding, largely terminated, if not completely so. It's unclear whether it terminated the entirety of the agreement, but that is certainly how it reads. Again, there's uncertainty because it does not appear that the folks doing the terminating actually understand the full scope of what that agreement actually entailed. But I think it's really important. This is where I want to read some of that document verbatim, and I'm just checking in briefly on the comments to make sure they're still going smoothly. It looks like they're all right now. So I want to read verbatim from the document published. Again, this is a verbatim excerpt from the Department of Commerce explaining why they terminated this agreement with Princeton University. And I'm reading it not so much because this is the most singularly important thing of all, but because I think the language here is very telling. It kind of gives away the game, the broader game, if you will. And I think it's important to understand, it's important context for understanding what I think is coming next at a much broader sense than just this one agreement. So I'm just going to read this aloud. And this is a verbatim quote until I note otherwise. So the quote reads, "This cooperative agreement promotes exaggerated and implausible climate threats, contributing to a phenomenon known as, quote, climate anxiety, which has increased significantly among America's youth. Its focus on alarming climate scenarios fosters fear rather than rational, balanced discussion. And additionally, the use of federal funds to support these narratives is misaligned with the administration's priorities." End quote. So this is essentially one of the most dramatic examples of gaslighting that I've seen in a long time. It's saying essentially that the reason why they're canceling the climate modeling agreement between the federal government and the world's premier geophysical fluid dynamics laboratory is because the kids are afraid of climate change that is made up. Obviously, that's just a gross mischaracterization of the factual reality of the world that we live in. But I think the most insulting part of it is probably the notion that the people who are anxious about climate change are anxious about something that isn't real, or that their fear isn't justified, or that the underlying threat isn't there. That's just factually inaccurate. So instead of saying we can make people less afraid about climate change by dealing with the problem, literally saying think of the children. And to think of the children, we should just pretend that it's not a problem at all, and let's not talk about it. More importantly, essentially, that Earth system modeling in general is misaligned with the administration's priorities. Okay, another quote, and again, this is verbatim once again. Quote, "This cooperative agreement suggests that the Earth will have a significant fluctuation in its water availability as a result of global warming. Using federal funds to perpetuate these narratives does not align with the priorities of this administration." End quote. So essentially now saying that the ability to foresee, understand, and predict variations in water availability in the United States for American interests is not in the interest of the administration. And to perpetuate false narratives that climate change is influencing the water cycle is somehow wrong. And of course, we know, again, this is just factually inaccurate, but it is extraordinary to have it written in such plain terms. And again, this is why I really wanted to read some of this verbatim, because I think it's important to understand the language that's being used to justify much of what we're talking about. So what this document really tells us is it's a little bit of an updated blueprint. I've talked before and I've read verbatim, if you're interested, from the sections in the Project 2025 document that so many people insisted would not become a policy blueprint for the current administration, but by all accounts is really just an absolute checklist for what has happened thus far in so many realms. In fact, there's even a website you can go to right now which shows you, in the form of a checklist, which of the Project 2025 specific objectives have been achieved. Many of them have or are on the way to being achieved. But I think this particular document, even though it's just a page referring to what's going on at Princeton, tells us a lot about how the things we're about to talk about and we're about to experience will be justified. So this brings me now to the breaking news from late last week. I think this was a Friday news dump last week. What's known as a passback document from the White House, the executive branch. That in itself is not unusual. Those documents are leaked in every administration, and they often make news for having, you know, proposing bold cuts or huge changes to the federal budget that people don't like for whatever reason. That part itself is not so unusual. But what is extraordinary in this document is the level of the proposed draconian, really existential cuts to, for among other things, weather and climate science in the United States and operational application of weather and climate science in the United States. And the other thing that's different, I think, this time around is that often, you know, these make newsy headlines around this time in the passback document, which is essentially a proposed budget, is that there's this notion that, well, Congress has to approve whatever the budget is ultimately, and usually it's quite different from whatever is proposed by the White House, and whatever the huge cuts often get attenuated. But there's two reasons why I think we cannot make that assumption. In fact, why I think that's probably an erroneous assumption this time around. The first is that in general, many large-scale cuts have already been made through Elon Musk's Doge project, which has been operating under mysterious auspices and under authority that it remains constitutionally unclear at best. But in any case, many of the changes we've already seen at NOAA, at NASA, and the Weather Service, and in the National Institutes for Health, and so many other entities, federal entities, have occurred without any input from Congress whatsoever. And even though the congressional appropriations for the budgets for these entities has not changed yet, because we haven't had that conversation yet in Congress, people have been fired anyway, institutes have been closed anyway, research projects have been ended, contracts and grants have been canceled regardless. So there's already a clear precedent and mechanism in recent weeks and months for these kinds of changes to be implemented long before Congress has any say, before the legislative branch gets to exert any kind of moderating influence. And secondly, and this was something that came up in a conversation with some journalists this morning who've received copies of this leaked document and were able to confirm this for me, is that in the document itself, this passback document, it is requested that agency and department heads in the federal government prepare a plan for implementation immediately, long before the budget for 2026 is reviewed and approved by Congress. In fact, there is supposedly a clause in this passback document that demands that administrators, high-level agency heads and administrators, provide a written plan for implementation by April 24th. I'm looking at the calendar. That's in 10 days. Congress is not looking or reviewing at this budget anywhere near that timeline. So my concern is that this is essentially going to be used as an excuse for Elon Musk's Doge or whatever mechanism is next to sort of implement the kinds of things that I'm about to talk about almost immediately. This is something that there was some initial skepticism this is going to have to pass through Congress first. I am not convinced at all that's actually the case. Even if it were the case, there's a question of how much pushback there would be from Congress in the present environment. I won't speculate on that, but I will say that there's a clause that is essentially trying to get agencies and departments to comply with this within weeks, really within days. Okay, so what is actually in this proposal? Well, the most prominent thing is to close entirely the NOAA Office of Oceanic and Atmospheric Research, or OAR. This is the branch of NOAA that funds research of all kinds, weather, climate, oceans, disasters, wildfires, you name it. It provides internal funding within NOAA for NOAA scientists in some cases, but it's more famous for providing external funding. So to scientists employed by universities, for example, to professors. I have applied, although never received, a NOAA grant to do research in the past. They are highly competitive. To essentially cover the costs of doing the research in whatever field they're in. In this case, NOAA obviously is funding ocean, atmosphere, climate, weather, fire research, as you would expect an agency with the words ocean and atmosphere in its name to be funding. This passback document, this proposed budget, calls for completely eliminating that office within NOAA. Not quite zeroing out its budget, giving it a sort of a small residual budget, but then shunting it into other parts of NOAA and completely eliminating the office as a separate entity, and essentially ending all climate research funded by NOAA, either internally or externally. Full stop. 100%. Also, it says that it would, the document claims to largely preserve weather research, but that is clearly not the case when you actually look at what is proposed. In fact, there would be massive cuts to weather research as well, partly because a lot of what is characterized as, quote, climate change research is actually, in practice, extreme weather research, because increasingly, extreme weather is strongly affected by climate change. But in any case, this would be really a decapitation strike against climate research within NOAA. Simultaneously, NASA, in the same passback document, is actually targeted for even larger proportional cuts. We're talking like 50% cut to the entire organization of NASA, and almost just a scorched earth policy when it comes to planetary science research. The Earth is a planet, and so Earth science, and therefore weather and climate research sponsored by NASA, is then included in what is almost completely zeroed out in this budget. So again, no more climate research from NOAA. No more climate research from NASA. Full stop in this budget. In addition, many of the cooperative research centers, if not most of them, run by NOAA would be completely closed. Additionally, entire NASA facilities, including some that employ as many as 10 to 15,000 people each, would be completely shuttered. That includes NASA Goddard in Maryland, for example. The short version is in its own summary of this document is that it, quote, cuts all funding for climate, weather, and ocean laboratories and cooperative institutes in the United States. The important thing to understand here is that I don't think we should view these as things that are hypothetical cuts, or that things that probably won't happen, or things that will likely get attenuated by Congress or in the final budget for whatever reason because the administration changes its mind. I think we need to take all of this, as I've been saying for a long time, at literal face value and assume that this is actually something that, unless something is done to dramatically shift public opinion, and public opinion therefore shift the political tides at the moment to really be opposed to this, that it's probably going to happen. And if it did, it really would spell the end of most publicly funded climate research in the United States. There is other climate research through other federal agencies like National Science Foundation, for example, Department of Energy, to a certain extent, the USDA and other institutions as well. However, some of these have already been quite decimated, particularly the climate programs, as I've already been talking about this year. And frankly, given the language used here, I think we're going to see very similar cuts and proposals, and probably attempted implementation at least, at all these other entities that also sponsor climate research. The fact that the NSF and DOE haven't seen the same level of cuts, I do not find that all reassuring. I just think that they haven't gotten to it yet. If you view Project 2025 as a literal, temporally expanding contiguous checklist, it's next. So we'll see what happens there. But I want to just once again offer a quote from that document, from the passback document itself, because I think, again, it's really important to understand that the language that the federal government is using to articulate why it's trying to pursue these goals. Essentially, the stated reason for zeroing out climate research, for getting rid of all these research institutes, for ending really all federal support for anything that's even remotely climate or climate change or extreme weather related, is the following: the need to, or the desire to, be seen as, quote, eliminating the federal government's support of woke ideology, end quote. That is the stated reason. So that's not me making it up. That's not me embellishing or inferring anything. That's a verbatim quote from the document that proposes these existentially huge cuts. And I don't relish that in any way. But that is what is going on. That's the kind of language that federal government employees are getting in their inbox every day to describe why they're lazy, low productivity, why they've been brainwashed by the woke mob. I mean, these are not terms that I'm using as a human being, as an American citizen. These are terms that the federal government is using to describe its own civil servants and the policies of previous administrations. Simply, we cannot replace the entire federal research infrastructure, the entire federal predictive services for weather and climate and disaster response through charitable or private funding. It just is not going to happen. And so if we lose it, we're going to lose it. It's not coming from somewhere else.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
From Weather West, you just heard excerpts from the two-hour live stream hosted by Dr. Daniel Swain. Find him at weatherwest.com and find a link in my blog for that YouTube video. We just learned from some of those troublesome scientists that 31 out of 34 global regions will hit 2 degrees C by 2040, not long from now, with 26 regions reaching 3 degrees C by 2060. That's the catastrophe level. So the heat is coming, whether you are anxious or not. And the kids should be anxious. We all should be anxious. Long-standing weather systems that fed and protected us are being disrupted, and it's knowingly to keep profits for the few. There is money to be made wrecking the earth, and so Naomi Klein insight, which she called disaster capitalism. On Radio EcoShock, scientists talk directly to you. Now many of them are afraid to speak. It is a struggle to keep this weekly show going. We are all in this struggle, and surrender is not an option. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about this world, no matter what.